welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, host of Talk of the Nation on NPR, Neil Conan. He joined APTI's Pat Yak for an onstage conversation at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage as part of the APRN Speaker Series held on April 19th.
Thanks all of you for coming. My name is Pat Yak, and I'm the Vice President of Public Media at APTI. If you've not been with us on a night like this before, thank you for being with us. This is the first this is one of many the APRN speaker series that we have, and we appreciate Neil being here tonight. I want to give special thanks to the Provost, Mike Driscoll, and the UAA's Office of Academic Affairs for the support for this evening's program, and to Cindy Stoklin, who is our Commander-in-Chief of Special Events, so thanks to them as well. It's a real honor for me to introduce our guest tonight, Neil Conan, who is the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He brings three decades of news and radio experience to the program that reaches about 3 million listeners at about 300 NPR stations around the country.
3.5 and 370, but.
There we go. He's worked as a reporter, a producer, an editor, executive producer, foreign editor, managing editor, and news director. He's won multiple national awards for his part in NPR's coverage of the Gulf War, war in Iraq, and 9/11. He's been an answer to a New York Times crossword puzzle question. It's a real honor. A minor league baseball play-by-play announcer. And honored in a romantic television reporter in Marvel Comics X-Men, which I hope he'll tell us a little bit more about. So please give a warm Alaska welcome to Neil Conan. I feel like I'm channeling James Lipton here with all these scars, but I wanted to cover a lot of ground. Welcome back to Alaska.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
And you were telling me a little bit about your past trips to Alaska.
I was here in Anchorage last, in, I think, 1981. And I'm just glad to see the place hasn't changed a bit. We were doing a public radio training session for public broadcasters here in Alaska. And I think the Cook Hotel had just gone up. It was pretty special, a long time ago. Stayed and did some stories up on the D2 legislation and a couple of other pieces. I think I did the Midnight Sun baseball game. Did a story on that. Then was back in Alaska in Fairbanks two summers ago to do a lecture up there at the university, and came up with my daughter. And then last year, my girlfriend and I were on vacation in the Wrangell Mountains riding horses. I never knew horses could do those sorts of things, much less with me on their back. And it was just a great time.
Well, great to have you back. If you read anything, if you Google Neil, you will see that he was born in Beirut in 1949. So then you go to 1977. So I want to fill in some gaps about your storyline.
Sure.
You're born in Beirut in 1949, and your dad is a doctor.
I was running the medical school at the American University of Beirut. And did that for 2 years, and then got a job as medical director of a new hospital being opened by Aramco in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. And so we moved to Saudi Arabia for a couple of years, and then to exotic New Jersey.
Your mom?
My mom was I think would have been a great deal happier had she been born later in a world that was more oriented towards working women. I think she was very frustrated by being a homemaker and housewife, and was much happier when she was doing a lot of volunteer work. That didn't often work out. And she died when I was a teenager of a brain hemorrhage.
Siblings?
I have I'm the youngest of four. My eldest sister, she loves it when I call her that, is a now retired Unitarian minister in Boston. And is that for her retirement? You've heard her preach. She is the mother of a name you may also be familiar with on public on NPR, J.J. Sutherland, who's he's my nephew, the youngest son of my oldest sister. Again, she loves it when I say that. My brother Mike died of cancer about 20 years ago. My other sister Lucy lives in San Francisco, way out by the ocean, where you can be out there and it's totally foggy, and the rest of the city has been enjoying wonderful sunshine. Interesting place to live. She's a retired nurse.
And I read some nurses.
Again, clearly people who've been in her care.
I read somewhere that because science wasn't involved, you weren't interested in being a doctor.
No, I was interested in being the doctor. I just never did well in any of those subjects in school where there was only one right answer. If I could start off with the causes of the Civil War were several. I was in good shape there, but if the answer was 4.8,
you were talking earlier about your path to NPR. But what made you want to be a journalist to start with?
I actually got interested in radio before I got interested in journalism. Radio, when I started to listen to it growing up in New York City, we moved to New Jersey, then moved into New York City when I was in high school. And I started listening to radio when I was 14, 15 years old in a new and sort of different way. I was telling some of the people backstage beforehand that I started getting interested in public radio when I tuned in to what turned out to be the very first public radio fundraising marathon. And as you might imagine, this was more about the style than the content, which has not changed a great deal in those years. But this was, I'd heard growing up, and I think there are people in this audience who are familiar with the radio of the mid-60s, where it was either AM radio and, hey, time to pack the wax and hit the tracks, or FM radio, which was in those days, you're privileged to listen to us here in the city of fine music. And I liked the music on AM radio, but, you know, I suddenly heard people talking to me as if I was a person and telling bad jokes, and people talking in accents, which was unusual in those days, and women's voices, which were unusual in those days, and more important, people saying they needed me. They wanted $15 as a subscription for a whole year, and I could come up with $15, and I was so interested in this that I started listening and then went down to the radio station and started answering telephone calls as what was known in the trade as a greasy volunteer, and hung around pretty much my entire senior year of high school, as opposed to going to school, and got people to, pestered people to teach me stuff. And essentially, I've worked in radio ever since.
Did you study journalism in college?
I never went to college.
Never went to college?
Not a day. I took a year off before going to college. It's been a long year.
So tell us the story about your path to NPR.
I started working as a volunteer in radio, and then pestered, you know, then after, if you're not going to go to college, it's funny, the parents stopped paying for stuff. And so I was living in an apartment in, it sounds, Murray Hill in New York was a little piece of the Lower East Side transferred to 36th Street and Madison Avenue. And, but I still needed to pay the rent. And so I started working in radio as a technician and an announcer. And but I found that very much the most interesting parts. I started, the first full-time job I had was, it was a part-time job actually, was a volunteer in the drama and literature department. This was a long time ago in public radio. And so we were doing all sorts of interesting stuff, but the most interesting part of the radio station, again, this was the mid-60s, was the news department, which was covering the burgeoning anti-war movement, and this was really where I gravitated. And the first story I covered for the news department was a demonstration by the Soap Opera Actors for Peace. Soap, get a soap opera actor. So anyway, but that was I think for the period of the next probably 10 years, I don't think there was anybody on the planet who'd covered more demonstrations than I did. That was really where I got my start.
And then how did you end up at NPR?
At NPR, I did that worked at public radio. It was so long ago, it was listener-sponsored radio. It wasn't even public radio in those days. If you're familiar with the history of public radio, it's not uncommon that there was a purge due to internal politics. It never, it wasn't like the Trotskyists took control or anything. So was out of work for a while and then worked in commercial radio, the radio station owned by the Riverside Church, which could have been the NPR station in New York City. They decided to go commercial instead. And this was so long ago, the host of their evening news program called himself Bob Siegel. But that's how I met Robert. But we worked there for a couple of years and then was out of work again and started working because Bob had gone to work at NPR in Washington and started working as a freelance reporter in New York City for NPR, covering various things. And still remember the first story, news spot I ever filed was on an explosion and fire at the Adams Gum Factory in Long Island City where a river of molten chicle spilled into the street. Now there's a visual image for you. Eventually, as I was telling some people, I went to visit those folks down in Washington who I was freelancing for, and it was I'd gone down to the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore, Seattle Slough's Preakness, and then showed up at NPR on a Monday morning. Weekend, all things considered, had just gone on the air. 2 weekends before that, they had just fired the first producer of Weekend, All Things Considered, for various production sins. And I was the first warm body to walk through the door on Monday morning. You're producing the show next weekend. What? And they were explaining the format. It was the director of the show then was the now famous foreign correspondent, Deborah Amos. But she was then the director of Weekend, All Things Considered, and was explaining the format to me. My big question, I'd been in radio for 10 years, but always local radio. She was explaining then all the different posts in the clock at All Things Considered. And my first question was, you mean exactly on time? And that first show, that first edition of Weekend All Things Considered I produced ended so early because I was terrified of, as we say in radio, blowing the post. Previously undiscovered parts of the All Things Considered scene were broadcast that evening. I've managed to get over that.
I'd like to go to your second day on the job and the current job that you've got. September 11th, 2001. Starts off, it is a pretty normal day for you when you go to work. And tell us about that day for you.
That day was my first full-time job, first full-time day at Talk of the Nation as the host was the day before. And this is a show that had been done for many years by Ray Suarez. Robert Siegel had done it for some period of time, Jock and Hockenberry, of course, Juan Williams just before me. And you keep trying to think of how are you going to put your stamp? How are you going to make this different, new, interesting? How are you going to essentially compete with your predecessors? And the next day, the world changed. I had been lucky enough, however, to have done all sorts of things in radio and in news by then. So I'd been a foreign correspondent for NPR, the London correspondent. I'd covered wars in the Middle East. I'd covered the Pentagon. I'd covered the White House. I'd covered the State Department. I'd done a lot of different things. I'd been a general assignment reporter in New York City for a very long time. So I was coming into the job with, it turned out to be, just about the best preparation you could have to cover this terrible, terrible story. And as soon as I came in that morning, by the time I got there, the first plane had already crashed into the World Trade Center, the first building in the World Trade Center. And I knew already that whatever we had planned that day, and no, I don't remember what we had planned that day, but whatever it is was not going to be on the air that day because the fire in the World Trade Center was way too big for this to have been a small plane, which a lot of people thought it was. And I don't claim any great prescience, but there was still a lot of discussion about what we were going to do. And I knew what we were going to do and was mentally prepared for it. And then the second plane hit, and it was clear that we were under attack. So that made all things evident. And then, of course, the plane hit the Pentagon. We heard about the crash earlier. So we went into what we call rolling coverage. This is, I had done for years NPR's live events, whether that was congressional hearings for the confirmation of Supreme Court justices, or I did 6 months of my life I'd really like back, which was the impeachment hearings. So I'm used to doing live radio. I've done it my whole life. I've been in radio since I was 17 years old. And we started out at noon, taking over from Bob Edwards, who just finished his shift on Morning Edition, and did it from noon to 4 when the All Things Considered crew took over. And then we came back at 10 o'clock when they went off the air until 1. Scott Simon came in at 1 and then filled in the 4 hours until Morning Edition came back at 5. Day-night doubleheaders, we called it. And we did that for about 2 weeks until they figured out some other way to do the overnights. And there was a special bond, I thought. There were so many people. All the aviation, of course, was shut down, as you'll remember. And there were so many people trapped in various parts of the country trying to get home and renting cars. All the cars turned out to be rented very quickly, or hiring U-Haul vans or whatever to try to get home across the country. Listening to radio in the dark of night as they were driving from one place to another, and listening to NPR as you could find the coverage on various parts of the nether reaches of the FM dial as you move from place to place. And I've always thought we had a special bond with those people who listened to us in those nights. And it was a terrible, terrible story. It's obviously shaped our lives tremendously ever since. I did run into Siegel in the hallway about a week into it and says, "Not bad for a couple of old farts." Because it turned out that everything we had done our whole lives was, in a way, preparation to do this story. Maybe there were no two people who had spent more time doing different things who were better placed to do that sort of coverage, the stuff we had done our whole lives. So we were perfectly prepared to do that. In an odd way, you hate to think of it, but it was a time when NPR was another level of maturity.
A number of years ago, you had on Phil Sieb, who was talking about Edward R. Murrow and the bombing raids in London.
Mm-hmm.
And he had written a book exploring just how objective he had been during mm-hmm. the course of the war, and many people who have some arms linked to those reports or him think that he was quite objective. But as the book noted and the two of you talked about, in fact, he was not very objective.
And he was cheerleading,
He was cheerleading. He painted the British as very patriotic and the Germans as evil.
Understandable if you're beneath the bombs.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the midst of 9/11, do you ever have a sense that objectivity should be suspended for a different calling or a different purpose when you're on the air like that and you have that kind of bond with listeners?
It's a very powerful moment, and radio is a very powerful medium because you are speaking to people in a way that I think even people on television are not, and certainly reporters in print are not. Your distance between you and their brains these days, wearing earbuds, is almost non-existent. You're literally speaking in their heads, or the spaces between the speaker and the ear. But I think we make a false paradigm to suggest that sometimes there are always two sides, or indeed three, four, five, six, seven sides to a story. You want to understand why people did what they did, but atrocity is atrocity. Massacre of innocent civilians is massacre of innocent civilians. You can't describe it as anything else. The actions of the police and fire units in New York City were nothing less than heroic. Some of them, then after, did rifle through people's offices and steal stuff. You got yelled at for mentioning that. These heroes of 9/11 were human beings who were tempted by things sitting around. You had to report that story too. But people who run to the sound of the guns, or people who dash into burning buildings and try to rescue other people's lives, I'm sorry, those people are heroic, and you have to describe their actions as heroic. The people who spent so much time volunteering at Ground Zero trying to find remnants, either people who were alive, it turned out there were very few of those, or remnants of bodies, I think, did important work. Their lobby afterwards, other than their lobby for health coverage, which is appropriate, but their lobby afterwards is sort of a patriotic lobby in the sense of, this goes back in American history to the Grand Army of the Republic. Veterans of various conflicts take on political roles which are not always appropriate, I don't think. That gives them a special place to talk about politics. Gives them a special place to talk about health care, yes. But I don't think we were, to describe that act as evil, it's a word that George W. Bush used, and it, I think, resonated with the American people because that act was evil. To say that it was in response, not in response to other things that the United States had done, well, that's just silly. Of course, we had to talk about those things too, that this was, in a sense, blowback, payback for things that the United States had done in the Middle East and elsewhere. Sure, you talked about that too. The fact that this was an atrocious act by people who should be punished to the full extent of the law, that's absolutely true. So I think we have to be careful about that sort of false, we've been talking about it a lot lately, the false he said, she said, that sometimes there is just one side to the story. I'm sorry, you want to explore what the Nazis have to say about death camps, but it's not that it is an evil. It is.
NPR prides itself on the serious coverage that it provides to its listeners, and certainly your show program does as well. But occasionally you will get off and you will explore some other topics. I think the other day it was the silly games that we all get addicted to, like Angry Birds. So what's the listener response to when you sort of break what might be thought of as the pattern, which is a serious program for serious-minded people?
You get two responses. Most people, I think, enjoy it and take it for what it is. And other people call in and say, there's a war in South Sudan. How could you waste our time talking about such silly nonsense? We can't spend all of our time talking about the important stories of the world. It's not that we don't ignore them. It's not that we ignore them, excuse me. We spend a lot of time, and I think more time than any other medium, taking these stories very seriously. To have an organization, I've spent most of my life, other than before I started on Talk of the Nation, one way or another, building up NPR's foreign desk. This is an institution, not just me alone, there are many other people, I'm not taking credit for this, but I am one of the people who developed this institution. I was producer of All Things Considered in 1979 when we were trying to cover the Iran hostage crisis. And there was literally no one. We did not have a foreign desk. There was nobody. We started calling up the wives of the correspondents of the New York Times and the Washington Post, most of them former reporters, who were based in various places in the Middle East. This worked out. One of them was Cokie Roberts. So we constructed something which is now one of the great treasures, I think, of American journalism, which is the NPR Foreign Desk. When I was the London bureau chief, I was the only staff reporter, as I like to say, between Montauk Point and Diamond Head. It would have been more appropriate to say the Golden Gate Bridge. We didn't have anybody in Hawaii either. And from there to the point where I think we have 17 foreign bureaus, more reporters overseas than any other institutions, I think, than the BBC, maybe CNN, and maybe the New York Times, and Al Jazeera. This is really important thing that we have all built together. And we take the world seriously. Those who you will find saying the most terrible things about us on the floor of Congress listen religiously, I would say, because they need to be informed about a lot of issues they would not hear about otherwise, because nobody else covers Africa. Nobody else has those numbers of correspondents in places like India and China. The Bo Xilai story, for example, to which we've devoted three programs so far, the most fascinating glimpse we've had into Chinese Communist Party politics since Tiananmen has been covered extensively on NPR, and this is something that is treated as, other than in newspapers like the New York Times, you know, this big in other newspapers that are running little AP. This is a fascinating story. But we have to leave time for people to catch their breath and realize that we do other things in the world, and some of it's Angry Birds. And that's okay, too.
What are some of the challenges of doing a show?
The challenges of doing a show, balancing what we do, balancing the amount of stuff that we prepare in advance. There's sort of a constant tension on the program between the producers of the program in the trade are called bookers because they book people on the show. And they are interested, they have a vested interest in what they have prepared. As the host of the show, I have a vested interest in being sort of saying we need to be topical, we need to be reflecting the topics that people are really talking about today. And so I'm sort of the designated anarchist to say we should blow it up and do something else. So there's that constant tension. There is the tension of taking stories or issues that people have their minds pretty well made up about, the Middle East, abortion, guns, and finding new ways of framing these conversations. These are very important issues. After the Trayvon Martin thing, I think a lot of people are talking about guns in a way that comes up. It didn't a lot after Virginia Tech. Not so much, for example, there was just a few weeks ago that terrible shooting in that religious college in Oakland, where I think 7 people were shot to death. After each of these incidents, there tends to be a story about, well, part of the problem is doing a story about the perpetrator rather than the victims. Part of the problems is doing knee-jerk stories about should these people have access to guns. It was much more appropriate, I think. We don't really know so much about the Oakland shooter yet, but the disturbed young man in Virginia Tech who had a history of treatment. So should he have had such easy access to guns? But to frame these conversations in ways that are illuminating and not just reflecting people's hard and set opinions about should we or should we not have access to guns, what kinds of guns, how big the magazines should be, should we even have regulations that cover machine guns? And so these are constant challenges to frame these stories so we're having a conversation, we're not just screaming at each other, because yelling at each other doesn't accomplish a great deal. It just sort of hardens the opinions everybody already has. So we're trying to find ways to get into people's lives to hear how guns have changed people's lives for better or worse, and it's both. And so that people listening on who might have a different opinion might hear somebody tell a story about their life, an experience they've had, and rethink what they thought was a pretty hard and fast opinion. Rethink somebody's conversation about the decision they made whether or not to have an abortion and how that changed their lives, about having the option available, or how this experience has shifted their thinking. And that elevates this to a different plane, I think, and gets us to a conversation as opposed to saying this is an absolute right for a woman to have, this is murder. So you're not going to get to a lot of places if you're having the conversation on that level because it's pretty hard and fast.
What's the role of sharing stories in your programs?
It is absolutely central to our show is called Talk of the Nation. And we embrace the idea that it's a call-in show, that we listeners play an important part of it. And I have to say, not all the time. There's things we book. There are shows we book that are explanatory programs about issues involving conflicts in the Middle East or Africa, in various places where we know we're not going to get a lot of phone calls, or not a lot of phone calls we're going to put on the air. Because it's opinions, I'm not really interested in opinions. I'm interested in people's stories. I'm interested in your opinion if you're an expert on it. I'm not interested if you're not. One of the fundamental changes we made in the program about 5 years ago the default question on Talk of the Nation was always, join the conversation, 800-989-8255. We changed that to, tell us your story. Because people are experts on their own lives. People can tell each other stories about their lives that resonate with other people in ways that opinions don't. So approaching people's stories, we are creatures who learned language, who learned experience from stories. We are creatures who grew up in the cave, and the fundamental question of the human experience is, and then? And then narratives, stories of what happened as you were hunting or gathering. These are how we tell each other about our lives and about how we interact with the natural world and the world around us. So these are how we evolved stories about the sky gods who bring the thunder and the rain god and the spirits and other things. We tell stories about these sorts of things. This is the fundamental human condition. And one of the, I was speaking to a group of reporters at a workshop today over at the university. We are specialized storytellers, but we are storytellers. We have to remember this all the time. Everything we do should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. As an editor, and I've worked in various roles at NPR, I used to tell reporters, you can diverge from the structure of chronological order, but you'd better have a really good reason. Chronological order, it can have problems of its own, but it is really easy to understand on the radio, where you're telling a narrative. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. It can lead you into false cause and effect. Because something happened before something else happened does not necessarily mean it caused it. You have to be careful about that, but that's when you're getting into journalism and scholarship. That's what you're trying to do. But we are storytellers, and we tell stories. So this is how I think how human beings interact fundamentally. And I guarantee you, I don't think human existence would have lasted as long as it has or been as successful as it has if people were yelling at each other over the campfire about their opinions, because they would have killed each other.
You've done so many programs over the years. How do you know when you've done a good one? When you come home at night, you say, yeah,
we nailed that one. You can feel it. You can, after those many years, you know when you're getting great stuff. But it's interesting, the reward for doing a great show and the penalty for doing a bad one is exactly the same. You have to do it again tomorrow. So you can't, it's a little like baseball, where if you go 0-4, you can't get too depressed, and if you go 5-5, you can't get too excited, because you've got to do it again tomorrow. It's a daily thing. So, you know, after you finish the show, you've got to say, we have a meeting every day, what lessons can we learn from what we did well or badly today? What systems worked well, what didn't? We try to learn every day about what succeeded and what didn't and why. And then you have to let that go and say, well, tomorrow, what are we going to do tomorrow? And how are we going to apply those lessons? And they're systematic lessons, it tends to be, to tomorrow's program, so that we can be good tomorrow.
National Public Radio went to NPR.
Mm-hmm.
And it did so for a lot of reasons beyond shortening the name. From your perspective, what are some of the things that are happening in NPR as it adjusts to this new communications world?
Again, there were some people who were backstage beforehand, and I apologize if I'm repeating some stuff. The overall audience for radio is diminishing, AM and FM, as people find other ways to have fun with their computers during the day. Sadly, more and more of us are actually working during the day. I think this is a terrible trend. They should be listening to the radio. But because of that diminishing audience, we have to find new ways. If you look at the demographic of people who listen to radio in general and public radio specifically, For example, for our program, the average age is 55 years old. This is not a formula for growth. So you have to find a way to reach people who are a little bit younger than that and inculcate the habit of listening to what we do, or consuming, as the new phrase, what we do. I sure hope we come up with a better word than that. And this is a challenge because younger people, you'll find, don't own a radio. They don't have one in their homes. They will have one in their cars because the car comes with it. But they tend to plug in their iPod or their MP3 player and listen to that. So we have to find new ways to reach younger people. Pat, I know, used to be an ink-stained wretch. And newspapers are having the same problem, too, the habit, it always used to be thought, young people would start reading the newspaper when they were about 35 years old and started to take the world a little bit more seriously. That's not happening anymore. The audience for newspapers, I think the median audience is even older than that for public radio. And so we have to find ways. It's our share of that diminished radio audience is growing. Our raw numbers continue to grow as more and more people become aware of us, but that doesn't change the demographic. So we have to be aware of that and seek out new ways to engage people digitally. What we mean digitally is through their computers. And there are any number of ways to do that, through downloads of podcasts, through people going to the website to read what we do, and then hopefully click on what we do best, which is radio. There is sort of a tension between that and between how we see this future, which is inevitable, that radio is going to diminish, and the other part hopefully will grow. And we haven't figured out a way to make money on the web. Very few people have. Even the pornographers are struggling. And so that's a sad state of affairs. The ability to communicate through a website has not been the same as people listening to the radio. There is an intimacy that you develop with the people you hear every day on the radio. There's a sense of trust. There's a sense of fellowship. There's a sense of companionship that doesn't really communicate the same way on the web. In McLuhan's terms, radio is a very warm medium, and it turns out that the web is not so warm. And so that kind of relationship, I think, has a lot to do with the willingness of people to say, yes, I want to support this. Yes, I want to be part of the public radio community. This is a model that has worked since the days when I was seduced into going and answering telephone calls when I was 16 years old. And this, I think, has a compelling story. The numbers of people, if you have a podcast that is downloaded by 50,000 people, this is considered a great success. An audience of 50,000 for a national radio program is going to get you canceled tomorrow. We have an audience of about 3.5 million people per week. That is so much greater than the number of people who listen to NPR either by streaming or by downloading podcasts or any other digital technique, that it's ridiculous. Those of us who have been in radio and NPR for our whole lives feel it's really important to emphasize the fact that basically we're in the radio business. That's how most people consume what we do. That's how we earn our daily bread. And that's how we build important structures like the Foreign Desk. That's what has accomplished that, radio. And it's not going away anytime soon. And we have to be careful about the percentage, the volume of resources that we devote to that seed corn, which is developing the digital side of it, until we figure out a way that can contribute too. It's getting better. There is an advertising model on the web that is useful. Podcasts have, you could put advertisements on podcasts. We call them underwriting announcements in public radio. Excuse me. And that tends to work. But it's not working yet. And there are any number of institutions, and you're seeing the New York Times struggle with its paywall. The Wall Street Journal seems to have figured out they do well with their, because they have very specialized information that people are willing to pay for. But those are the only people that, it's interesting. It's going to be very interesting to see how this model works and to see how it develops. But the idea that people who are fundamentally in the radio business are going to put out a product on the web that is somehow going to compete with the New York Times every day, we're just not. We don't have the number of people to do that in a print form on the web that the New York Times does. We're just not going to be able to do that. I think our web product is pretty good, but it's pretty good compared to the New York Times. It's not so good. Our radio, you listen to what the New York Times does in terms of audio, well, we kick a little butt there. So we've got to figure out a way to marry these things, and they haven't figured out a way to make a profit off their website either, and that's the most visited news website in the country. So it's going to be a real challenge, but if it was easy, everybody would do it.
So if you have questions, please come over to the mic. And while people are doing that, I'm going to have a poker party at my house in a couple of weeks. And I'm calling you up and I say, you know, of all the people that have been on your show, who would you like to come over and play poker with us?
Well, me.
Yeah, I'm inviting you.
Okay. That's interesting. This is a way of, it's a very engaging way, and Pat's smart. It's a way of saying, who are the most interesting guests you've had on your show? And the fact that there have been a lot of interesting guests. I would like to play poker with Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton would be fun to play poker with. I think Bill would be hard to bluff. On the other hand, I'd think he was bluffing all the time. And I think mostly I'd be right. Bill seems, doesn't he seem to be, there are guys who play poker, it's mostly guys, I'm using the modern expression of that. They like to see cards. They stay in the game, they've got a terrible hand, but they stay in the game to see more cards. You love to play with these people. And Bill Clinton seems to me as a guy who really likes to see cards. And because he likes to have something to talk about during the, I think Bill Clinton would be a lot of fun to play with, poker with. There are any number of people who we have on the show who I think would be fun to, but it is unusual for me. I have the first change I made on the show, this was September 10th, 2001, is I want a sheet of paper in front of me every day. We have these little plastic easels. I want a sheet of paper in front of me with everybody's name, every guest's name and title, and if they wrote the book, I want the title of the book there, because he could sit down, I can be introduced to him, I can have researched him, and I will forget his name like that. I can remember the batting order of the New York Yankees from 1956. But I can't remember anybody's name. Don't ask me why. It's just the way my brain works. I can remember obscure facts. So we were very obscure facts. But people's names I have a hard time with. So people say, who are you? I can't remember anybody's name. So please don't ask me the question. Bill Clinton's name, I remembered. He had something to do with that impeachment thing.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. Recorded at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium on April 19th as part of the APRN Speaker Series, Neil joined APTI's Pat Yak for an onstage conversation and then responded to questions from the audience.
May I sneak in two questions? They're kind of quick.
Sure. Okay.
I read your book on baseball.
You're the one.
And I know that you rode your bike to do your job and that you don't drive, and I'm wondering if maybe you can tell us about that. And secondly, if you could talk about Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and that's my favorite show of the week, of TV or anything.
Mine too, thank you. I was in a number of accidents, one of them which I caused as a teenager, and so I have been neurotic about driving. This has nothing to do with saving the planet, believe me. So I have been taught by some of the, you know, people who teach blue-haired old ladies who've never driven how to stop being nervous. I do everything reasonably well up to about 15 miles an hour. So after a while, I decided, you know, I'm just not going to do this. People don't want me on the road. I don't want me on the road, and so I'm not just not going to do it. So I live on an island in the Chesapeake Bay and ride my bike now 5 miles to and from the bus stop every day. And it turns out, mostly in the summers, it guarantees you a seat by yourself. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, was Ken and I are pals. We are both diehard Yankee fans and diehard politics fans. We went to very different high schools in the Bronx. I went to a private school. He went to James Monroe. But we know a lot of stuff in common. We will have trivia games all the time on 60s and 70s pop. Ken came on the show. It was actually my idea to do this as a weekly segment about 5 or 6 years ago. And it started as the third segment on the show, and it quickly became, it is our most popular segment of the week, and it's my most favorite show of the week, too. So,
yes.
I imagine over the years that you have covered election fraud, we've had a little local phenomena here, and I'd like you to describe what you have seen nationally in terms of trends with election fraud and the performance of the Diebold machines.
Ah,
have been used
that story.
Elsewhere because it's very pertinent to our hometown. Thank you.
Election fraud on that scale, well, I grew up in New York City. We don't know anything about that. it was mostly a long and colorful history of machine politics who were people. I don't know if you ever seen a movie called The Great McGinty. The 1940s movie where a bright young man gets his start in politics by voting for the boss 78 times in one election in Chicago, in New York City, rather. But anyway, Preston Sturges' movie, wonderful piece of work. I think stories of election fraud by machine and election fraud by people voting under other names, misrepresenting themselves, I think in both cases tend to be overstated. Machines make mistakes. One of the things we learned in Florida during the election in 2000, was that there is a margin of error in close elections that you're never going to resolve. And the fact of the matter is you might as well flip a coin when it gets close enough, because you're never going to reach a number that on which everyone can agree between dangling chads or I don't think votes are stolen systematically, electronically, using the machines. I just don't. I don't think it has been a national story. It has been a national story, and the investigations of it have not proved that this has been done. There were stories about George W. Bush in the election of 2004 systematically stealing votes on the Diebold machines in places like Ohio. Nobody's ever proved it. So.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know if you've ever had any interaction with Karl Rove, and
no.
If so, what that relationship might be.
No, we've invited him on the show a few times, and he's never had the time. So it's interesting. Usually, those who would have, you know, ideological concerns about being on NPR, if they write a book, it's amazing how those concerns evaporate. And you can usually book them, but Carl has never found the time to be on the show. We've invited him several times. I think he's a bright man and an interesting force in politics, and I think he was an interesting, you know, what he did was really, really interesting. But, you know, I think people would like to talk to him. But that would be a hard one to frame a question for Karl Rove that would actually get people not to scream at him. So, but he's never been on the show.
Sorry. In regard to engaging a younger audience and expanding, do you think that news consumption and interest in kind of the world around us is something that doesn't really tend to happen in our society until you get older?
No.
Or
I think people, young people are more engaged in the world around them than ever before. They're just engaging it in different ways than we were accustomed to, because there are so many options with the computer to find out about things. But they tend to find out about things they are interested in. One of the delights of growing up reading newspapers, and one of my great skills, I have to say, that things that I do really well, is read newspapers. This is, it may sound silly, but Pat, you know, you can...
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. If you can make a living reading newspapers, this is the way to go. But the fact about newspapers or general interest radio programs is you find out stuff you didn't know you were interested in. You can turn the page and say, wow, I didn't know that, and then you read the story. If you, the way the searches on the web work, you're interested in this, therefore you can go into great depth on whatever it is you're interested in and not find out about the stuff that's on the page next to it. So I think people are more and more engaged, but because they are able to be more and more engaged, and they go into great depth on things in which they are interested, but they are interested in fewer things. It's not that they're not interested, they just don't know that they're interested. They would be if they were exposed to it. So that's a problem that we've yet to solve.
I think we can take one more question.
I want to express my admiration, which is bumped up a notch here, upon hearing your education. I don't remember being so shocked since I found out that Nina Totenberg didn't go to law school.
She didn't go to college. She attended college. She did not graduate. Let's put it that way.
All right. My question is about the Aberdeen Arsenal and why you chose that team rather than, say, a AA team. And don't tell me that they wouldn't have offered you a job.
You would be amazed how competitive those jobs are. I worked for the Aberdeen Arsenal, which is a team in independent league baseball. And the independents, as everybody, the standing joke was, well, we know it's not organized baseball. But outside the structure, minor league teams are affiliated with major league teams. So major league teams have a team in AAA, AA, high A, low A, short season A, and rookie leagues. And so anyway, I did work for a team in AA, the Bowie Bay Sox, as a part-time, when I was learning my craft. And they did not offer me a job. But the people who owned that team owned half of the Aberdeen Arsenal, and those were the people who had offered me the job. As my wife at the time put it, she was so pleased that I'd managed to find a sector of the broadcast industry that paid less than public radio. But if you want to do play-by-play, this is incredibly competitive. To get a job doing play-by-play for a AA team, they will get literally thousands of applications for this job. And to do that job, you are not only doing play-by-play for your team every night, you're the team statistician, you're keeping all the records, doing all those things, you also have to be a salesman to make up any kind of a salary. I don't have many scruples, but I'm not selling beer ads. I'm just not going to do it, partly because I don't think I'd be very good at it. So that's why I didn't stay on. If I'd gotten an offer to do a major league team, I would have done that in a heartbeat. Play-by-play is the most fun you could have on the radio. It is that. What I was telling you before, that narrative, the and-then question, the great thing about baseball is every pitch is the next step of the narrative. The game itself is the structure of the story, and what you're doing is weaving stories in and around the structure of the ball game. It is so much fun to do, and it's so challenging. There's no script. There can never be a script. You're preparing. You've got the two best pitchers in the league, and it's 10-7 in the third inning. There's no way you can be ready for all of the things that happen. You can be in the midst of a long, involved story because you're trying to kill time, and then there's a ground ball to shortstop, over to second for one, back to first, double play, and you got to wrap it up in 10 seconds because you got to go to the station break. It's so interesting to do that, you know, once I figured it out, and the woman who was kind enough to have read my book will know that it took me a while to figure it out, I was really worried I was going to get fired there for a while. But once I figured it out, it was so much fun. If I could figure out a way to do it, I'd do it for free if I had the money. It's enormous, great fun. The last few years, I've had the people who run WCAI, which is the public radio station in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. They have a number of repeaters. They're associated with WGBH in Boston, but they have a number of repeaters out on the Cape Cod. And they every year broadcast the Cape League All-Star Game. This is the premier amateur summer league. There's a summer league here in Alaska. There's a summer league. They're called wooden bat leagues because it's where college players can play with wooden bats for the first time. And it's interesting. The last couple of years, the games have been at Fenway Park, and they invite me up to do that, and I go every year if I can. Last year I was in Alaska, so I couldn't go. And this year I'm going to be in Alaska, so I can't go. That plus the privilege of saying, you called a game at Fenway Park? Are you kidding? You worked the broadcast booth at Fenway Park? Wow. All right, it was the Spanish language booth. But it was it was great fun anyway. The other part of it is that as I get older, I don't understand how Harry Carey and Phil Rizzuto and all those other guys, didn't their eyesight go like mine is gone? It's so hard to keep track, but I did remember I was lucky enough to have done a lot of interviews with Red Barber back in the days when he was on Morning Edition every week, Fridays with Red. And I sat in for Bob Edwards when he was writing his book, Fridays with Red. But if Red was an old man by that time and set in his ways, and those who substituted for Bob used to call that the most terrifying 4 minutes in radio, because Red did not like it when Colonel Bob was not there. And he would make this plain. You would work out the questions in advance with the producer who worked with him every week. And so you'd ask him the questions, and if it was Bob, he would say, well, Bob, you know, the calla lilies are down in bloom here, and you know the crepe myrtle, and go on and on about that sort of stuff. When there was a sub there, he'd give you a 5-second answer. And so you were through your question list in a minute and a half. And you had to kill another 3.5 minutes. My math is off, but it felt that way. This was terrible. But one thing he did teach me was never to follow the flight of the ball. Never watch the ball. Watch the fielders. They will tell you what to do. But Red covered games in the major leagues. If he'd covered the Aberdeen Arsenal, following the fielders did not always tell you where the ball was. So this was of limited value, but it did help.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Neil Conan, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He was recorded speaking at an APRN Speaker Series event hosted by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated and the Alaska Press Club at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium on April 19, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.